Jeremy.
I'm Chris.
This week on The Weekly, Return of HeroQuest, Honey and Hot Wax, Create Content for Mjork Borg, D&D, the new racial ability rules, and a little bit about Dune. Mm. A countdown has reached zero.
Oh, yes.
We have been waiting for, I don't know why, it was like a
10-day.
Yeah. I was like, I don't know why they did that.
Build up hype. I'm sure it did something.
It just made people go, huh? Yeah. HeroQuest is returning, and it is being crowdfunded on Pulse. And Pulse is the platform for Hasbro. Mm-hmm. I guess the Hasbro Lab. So Haslab.
Haslabs. I think it's Haslabs.
Yes. So the Haslabs system, or you know, whatever they're doing. So basically, their advanced pre-order system that prevents them from sending things to China with them without they're totally paid for in advance. We were worried about Hasbro.
Yeah.
I was like, they're on
still am worried.
They're on the Hasbro. They're on the brink. I think they're going to go under. So we need to make sure we buy their games in advance before they produce them.
10.2 million net worth company. Yeah.
It's a little odd. And I think this is inevitable. I think things are just going to, corporate interests are just going to encroach on everything that was originally kind of independent and bootstrappy and self-made DIY. That's all going to get consumed by this. And so, now these big companies are kind of aping the Kickstarter model, and not very well, though. It's a very, I looked at the campaign, it's very empty, kind of hollow. They don't know how to do it.
Right. Okay.
They're basically just making a pre-order that looks like a crowdfunding, and they put a goal, and they didn't even have to do that. It could have been invisible, because it would have been in the millions.
That's the thing. Like, given the product they were crowdfunding, there was no chance it was not going to fund.
Right.
So, like you said, they could have hidden that goal, or they just could have not put one. As you said, and as I've said in previous casts, I kind of side-eye people using a crowdfunding platform for things that they could have made on their own, but simply didn't want to take the risk.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, crowdfunding for me is supposed to be, or ideally for, people who would not otherwise be able to make their visions a reality. So you kick it out to the crowd to fund, but eventually I expect a company, especially one with a big net worth like Hasbro, to act like a company and absorb some of the risk.
Right.
Especially for something like HeroQuest that everyone knew was going to have immense interest.
Right.
So, as you said, they could have done anything and everything in terms of stretch goals and extra bells and whistles. And hell, it could have been a gold-plated board, I'm sure, and people would still have pledged at that level. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, that's true. So did you take a look at the art? Have you seen
what I have not taken a look at the art. I've taken a look at the page, and it looks like... since GW isn't involved, they had to change the old Fenner, whatever it was, to some kind of fish thing. They have alternate sculpts.
Right.
They changed the elf to the canonical character to, I guess, a woman, which, okay, whatever. And they also included female versions of certain monsters as well,
which
kind of struck me as... like corporate feminism, where it's like, yay, there's female monsters you can kill and loot too. And it's like, really? Like, I'm not saying they shouldn't be there, but it's kind of like, ooh, look, extra female miniatures that are cannon fodder like everybody else. Okay, whatever. So, yeah. Well, excited that it was kind of a reprint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
updated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what do you think about the rules, though? Are those interesting enough to, other than nostalgia, is it interesting enough to play that game?
I'm trying desperately to remember the rules.
I think remember them being incredibly simplistic. Did you use regular D6s?
Because
now they have, now, of course, they have the custom D6s. So I was wondering if they.
I like how in the Kickstarter, it kind of poo-pooed the old wooden dice from the other ones. And like, they worked, they were fine. They had exactly the same symbols. Yeah, I think it's right. You had the 2D6 for movement, and then you had like white dice that were like three skulls for hits, two shields for like a block, and maybe like an evil shield for like the overlord character, whatever.
Mm.
And basically you rolled those and counted up hits, and I think different weapons gave you different numbers of dice, but there weren't different funky dice like for an FFG game.
Right.
Those were always the ones you rolled, and they always had the same chance. So it's a board game.
Right.
Which doesn't mean it's bad.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not anything super duper special apart from the nostalgia.
Right. And it looks like they kept the board. Like the board looks...
I think so.
So you brought that up when we were talking about that before, and I was really surprised because it's not a particularly beautiful board, but
it's okay.
It evokes. it's functional, and it evokes the old game. Well, so I guess
here's the question. Mm-hmm. Like, the miniatures look different. I mean, they still have the spirit of kind of the old ones. The poses are more dynamic. Not a fan of the goblins with their big heads, whatever. If they had changed the art style of the board, what do you think fan reaction would have been?
I think it would have been too much. I think with the way the miniatures are more stylized and kind of it's a more specific kind of style and not so generic.
Right.
If the board would have gotten that same treatment as a lot of the graphics and card borders and stuff probably will. Yeah, I think there are people would have been like, this is not, I'll look for a used copy of the old one.
I bet you people still would have pledged and bought it, but there would have been a lot more complaining.
Yeah, I think so. No, I think that's a good point. I was convinced they were going to do like a total, close to a reprint original and then the new updated version.
Okay.
Yeah, I thought they were going to do kind of a both thing so you can get like this, because I think Milton Bradley or somebody was doing those old retro versions of Yahtzee and Clue and stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, when they were doing the old boards, you know, the really old graphics of the boards, just recreating those. So I thought this would be a chance to do that, and they have the power to do it, but maybe, like you're saying, GW's involvement, maybe the license, you lost some things from the original license.
I think you did, and I think some of, like the article I read said that some of the lore, hate that word, had to be scrubbed or updated from this new print because GW is not involved. And I don't remember there being that much lore from the thing, except from like monster names.
Right.
But, that's right, they couldn't say Chaos Magic. They probably couldn't say Chaos Warrior. It's now like Dread or something. Nice. Dread Magic, which, the same thing.
Well, they did bring back Stephen Baker, who was one of the original writers for the game. So he subsequently worked on Heroescape and Space Crusade. So
Now that's a blast from the past. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's involved and is going to be writing, I guess, new scenarios for it. So he's very excited about doing that. And then they mentioned a bunch of other people that were responsible for character designs or writing some descriptions or, you know, setting. And nobody that jumped out at me, nobody that I noticed. But yeah, so they are bringing one of the original creators back. There are two tiers for this. So the heroic tier is $99.99. The mythic tier is $149.99. And you just get the two kind of sparse supplements with the mythic tier. So it's two additional smaller boxes with a little bit of miniatures and a couple of tiles.
I don't think I had the two expansions that are listed as part of the mythic tier. I know I had at least one expansion, which was like the frozen one. Because I remember ice blue, like kind of yetis and bugbears kind of thing, and possibly one other, but I don't think it was those two.
Mm. Yeah, I'm not sure if this is the best approach to this, because if they would have really put some money into marketing this and getting people excited about this, hey, D&D seem a little too complicated, you 8-year-old kid. Look at this, because that's exactly how it worked, you know, when we were younger, is like, oh, the bigger kids are playing D&D, but we can do this, you know, because I play Dungeon, a ton. Yeah.
I did notice in the article they said that Hasbro was potentially eyeing a 2021 retail release.
Yeah, okay.
So maybe we'll see a more ramp up in terms of marketing there once we get closer to that approach. I have to think that this was a test the waters to see what kind of reaction it's going to get. And maybe as a fan, how could it not have sold out? But I do guess understand, you know, from the company standpoint saying, let's figure out whether or not this is going to sell and whether doing a reprint and a retail release later on next year is going to be worth it.
Right, right. The trademark, the rights to this game are a little interesting. And when we were talking about the HeroQuest Legacies, that was actually a trademark that was registered by Restoration Games. So that's the company that's bringing back the Dark Tower. They're doing the new version of Dark Tower. Basically, they say their strategy is to register trademarks for anything that looks hot. So they do like the five top like kind of search terms or things that are buzzing on board game sites or whatever. And they'll just register things related. So they weren't specifically involved in any of this, but that should have been proof. And maybe just doing a search on Board Game Geek would prove to Hasbro, this is hot enough that you don't have to crowdfund it. If they're going to crowdfunded, it should be a really exclusive version. So, and maybe I think though the gender swaps and things are not going to be in the retail version.
I think they're not. Yeah. The alternate gender swaps are not going to, of the heroes are not going to be in the heroic tier version. Yeah, I don't know. At a $99.99 entry point, that's boutique.
Yeah, yeah.
Not Kingdom Death Monster boutique, right? But that's boutique. You're not going to get the casual gamers. You're going after the hardcore nostalgia fans who are able to kick that in. And as much as I don't like Hasbro, I seriously considered doing it. I'm like, oh, that's real attractive, but when am I going to play it? And that's a bit expensive. So at that price level, why not, as you kind of said, go higher? Mm-hmm. With extra stuff,
because people
were gonna do it,
right. Yeah, but in their stretch goals and things, they're not really doing too much. Yeah, they're not really unlocking anything or kind of souping up the game. There's just a few tiers of things, and they're probably, because this is going on until I think November 6th.
Oh, is it?
It's going on way too long, and they're probably gonna make a lot of money. The total's gonna get pretty high, but there's not anything that's gonna change the game. Yeah, like make it more exclusive. But back to the rights, the so HeroQuest was originally produced by Milton Bradley, who was a subsidiary of Hasbro. And Games Workshop. 89 to 94, they produced the game. And then HeroQuest was registered as a trademark in 2002 for a role-playing, tabletop role-playing game. Yep. So after it stopped production in 94, it was picked back up. Moon Design Publications were the were the previous owner of the HeroQuest trademark that transferred it over to Hasbro. Yeah, so I don't know. We're going to see millions of dollars go into that. But if they would have studied what companies like Come On and things are doing on Kickstarter, I think they would have structured that campaign a little differently. They're wasting the time doing this countdown clock. They should have done all the gimmicks said, you know, you're going to get a wooden box and, you know, you're going to get some metal pieces or something to really get to drive up the, you know, people pledging on this. But basically, they're going to do what they've always been able to do, produce decent quality board games in China. Right. And so, yeah, that's it, Hasbro. Yeah.
Well, I mean, not really a fan of it, but I guess from a business point, that's the way to maximize profit.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I'd be interested. I mean, wouldn't be an expert on any of the legal language, but it'd be interesting to see what their terms of service say as far as like how they're going to, you know, what their responsibility to fulfill this crowdfunding is.
Oh, good point.
Shipping and everything. Because those are always the stumbling blocks that people run into. And I wonder if the language is really, if their lawyers like said, you know, if we never make this game, too bad. You
right. Know? I'm really curious. I never thought about that. Yeah.
But now we know. So it's not a mobile game. It is just the board game with mobile some new art. Yeah.
I wonder if they're going to come out with a mobile game or whatever. Because a couple people I saw on Twitter, when this got released, said something along the lines of, they hope Hasbro does something allowing people to write and publish their own scenarios.
Mm. Oh, that's cool. Yeah, yeah. So, have you heard of Honey and Hot Wax?
I have, though that's about the extent of it.
Okay. Well, we're going to try. We set a precedent last week with Morning Coffee for a New Lover. So, we're going to try to resist turning this podcast into Thirsty Christina's erotic game reviews.
Which is what I should go and label my itch.io storefront. All right.
So Honey and Hot Wax, I noticed this right away. It's an anthology of erotic games edited by Sharang Biswas and Lucien Kahn. And we mentioned Lucien Kahn's work in
Visigoths versus Morgoths.
Right, last week. So it was created with two grants from the Effing Foundation for Sex Positivity. So the intention of this is to create, you know, a sex positive, very kind of aware collection of games. And you can see that by the foreword of the book was written by Naomi Clark. Naomi Clark is the designer of Consenticle,
right,
which is
I have a copy of
Yes, right. which is a great card game based on the consent in a sexual relationship between a human and an alien.
Yep.
So
with tentacles, in case you couldn't tell, right, by the name Consenticle.
Right. And so that's handled very well. And so her kind of putting her stamp on this collection, I think, is a good sign. So it's a very interesting collection of games.
And we're going to review them all?
Right now. Right now. So it's 8 games altogether and kind of 2 categories.
Okay.
So they separate it into this world, so kind of, you know, reality or normal reality, and the and other worlds, which would involve, you know, supernatural or aliens. The nice thing that they do is they break down for each game how many players you need, what you need for the game, and if a facilitator or kind of game master is required. And so looking at some of the games, it seems like it would be hard to organize a few of these sessions.
Oh, really?
Because it's pretty large numbers of game, large numbers of players.
Okay. We're talking like 6, 8?
Yes, right. Oh, okay. Yeah, 6 to 12. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So I'll just go through a few of the examples that are listed here. So the first game is Pop. Pop is inspired by Lunars.
Okay.
Lunars is a community of people that like to have sex with balloons.
Okay.
But this game does not feature balloons. So 6 to 12 players and one a facilitator or game master and lots of material. So this one sounds particularly difficult to kind of pull off. If you have a good, you know, fun group, it may be nice. It may be a nice thing to do. The other thing is maybe less than half of the games would be possible to do online. In this age of social distancing, it might be a little bit difficult to execute some of these games. So the point of the game is you have a character with a simple goal to figure out exactly what makes this balloon thing so hot. Mm-hmm. But all loons are still treated with dignity and respect. The next game was The Echo of Unsaid. So this game will last about 1 to 2 hours and only needs 2 players. Mm. So it's 2 players, ostensibly straight college boys that have unresolved sexual tensions and perhaps romantic attraction. So you're playing out like hidden relationships between 2 players. The sleepover can last up to 5 hours and needs 3 to 12 players.
Wow.
And 2 facilitators.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay.
So this game is, it starts with the characters receiving the talk, an awkward sexual conversation from an adult about sex. And then the teens, which you are playing, explore their own identities in the game as they go on to challenge the talk. So I think that's okay, kind of interesting, fun content. Follow my lead, 6 to 10 players.
Wow.
Yes, I saw some of these are difficult. It's a nonverbal LARP about exploring kink negotiation. So Follow My Lead is upfront about its aims. It wants to capture kind of the essence of the mating dance, kind of the a nonverbal version of kind of the back and forth.
Hmm. I was thinking the nonverbal thing made me think of Consenticle.
Yeah, right.
Because one of the levels of difficulty for Consenticle is no speaking.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, I think, and that's an interesting thing, I think, that comes up back and forth. And here, this next one is a all verbal game. Mm. So Pass the Sugar, Please is a game about anonymous sex, exposed secrets, and BDSM. So 4 to 6 players are needed and a facilitator. So the game takes place at a particular elite sex club, House of Decadence, in which all the guests are masks and they engage in BDSM. But the main part of story of the game takes place the meeting that afternoon. So the characters are meeting for afternoon tea and discuss with other players through innuendo. So through food innuendo, you try to figure out who you hooked up with the previous night at the club.
Interesting. Slightly less interesting than only because for me, food and sex don't really mix. So the food innuendo, I'm kind of like, my interest is kind of down a little bit.
Oh, interesting. So The Cleft in the Rock is a game for 2 to 6 players and using landscape metaphors to talk about the body.
Okay, basically. I guess that's more my speed since it's not involving food.
Right. Feeding Lucy, I think, is exactly your speed. 2 or more players and 2 or more hours. And nothing is really needed except maybe some fake vampire teeth.
Okay.
But basically, it's inspired by the Lucy Westenra Good Girl Gone Bad journey in Dracula. You Inside Us is for 2 people. It's 2 players sharing 1 body. So a host and a symbiote. Mm-hmm. And they share senses. And so it's improvised role play with the host gradually succumbing to the symbiote's desires for sex.
Okay. I wonder how that would work.
Yeah, yeah.
Single that they share a bone. Okay.
So that's just a sample of kind of what you're going to find in there. So they scale. I mean, so the scale of them is pretty broad. So, you know, 2 players all the way up to 12-player games. So I think just the maybe the inspiration of like how you would sex positively include that content in a game is pretty inspiring, because I think that's a difficulty that happens in, you know, kind of mainstream tabletop is people negotiating what can I have sex with.
Negotiate?
Well, they don't negotiate. Okay, okay. They kind of brute force their desires on the merchant's daughter.
That is what I was saying. And then as soon as I said that, I was trying to kind of pull back from that stereotype, because it probably is a stereotype, it's the one that everybody in gaming probably is familiar with. And I'm sure people have horror stories about things that happen at the table. So I absolutely agree with you that this seems like a decent idea to actually have games about sex positivity. Not kind of explain things, but just, I guess, kind of normalize decent behavior. Mm-hmm. Because I'm sure these games use safety tools as well.
Right. Yeah. And they make in the introduction, they specifically talk about how to handle things at the table and kind of the role of the facilitator in each of the games. Yeah. So, yeah, I think the same way that people kind of explore identity and just kind of, you know, social roles and stuff, tabletop is a place to kind of figure out sexuality. And it may be a thing that you haven't given a lot of thought to.
RPGs are only for killing monsters and taking their loot. That's the only thing they're there for.
Right. So I think this is interesting. And if any of the settings or any of the games interest you at all, it's definitely worth checking out.
I am definitely going to check that out. I'm surprised. I want to say surprised, but that sounds kind of negative. I'm surprised at the number of people involved. Probably only because the games that I've made are for 1 or possibly 2 players.
Right, right.
So seeing list for up to like 12, like, wow, okay, that's a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Maybe it skews more LARPish because, again, just thinking like a facilitator. Wow, running a game with 12 people, that does not sound fun, you know?
Right. So. But you can buy a copy at Pelgrane Press, and so I'll put a link in the description to that. And yeah, it looks really fun, and we'll try not to only review sex games or only introduce sex games on the podcast.
Keyword there is try.
So do you have any interest in developing content for Mjölkborg, the award-winning dark metal RPG?
Possibly. I can't answer that question without looking at the system.
Okay.
Because the book looks amazing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think it won some kind of like Swedish design award.
Yes.
But I would possibly be interested in developing content for Mjölkborg, which I can't say without thinking about the Swedish chef.
Oh, right.
Anyway.
Well, good news. This may entice you a little bit more. They're offering an open license for people to develop. Basically, that gives you access to the game system. Mm-hmm. But you know, none of the art assets,
right.
The game system, and then also a compatibility logo.
Okay.
So you're not allowed to use logos from any of the developers or Free League, but you are able to designate your content as Mjölkborg compatible. And the best part is they take 0% cut on that license. So anything you make from the game is yours, you know, depending, minus credit card processing fees or whatever.
Right. I've seen other games do something similar. Like I think Evil Hat has stuff for Fate where they're like, okay, you can use this text from these books. You can't use our logo, but here's a Powered by Fate logo that you can use.
Mm.
And as long as you're within these parameters, you don't have to like buy a license or anything like that.
Right. Yeah, so we'll see. And I guess there's already a Carousing in the Dying World from Grayson Y is already on itch.io, which is content. Mm. You know, this will lean heavily into very gorgeously graphically designed content if you want to kind of match what the original system was.
I wonder if that's going to be a turnoff.
Mm.
Because based on what the Mjölkborg book looks like and the kind of style of art,
right.
I at least would want to try and mimic or emulate that. And I wonder if other people would too. And I wonder if the difficulty in it potentially being difficult to do that might be a turnoff.
And not being able to print your PDFs with metallic ink might be a little difficult.
Yeah. Where are you going to print metallic ink and spot varnish on that bright yellow? Yeah.
And I'm curious to see if that inspires people to develop for the system, because it's getting a lot of attention from the 2020 NES and things.
I think Quest that we talked about a couple episodes ago did something similar as well. And I think people are making Quest material or Quest content, though that seems to, at least from my feed, have tapered off.
Ah, I see.
Or not necessarily tapered off, but I don't really see people talking about it all that much.
Currently. Right. So we got a peek at, we were already kind of expecting in the next release for D&D, which was going to be Tasha's Cauldron of Everything. We were going to get new rules that let you kind of break free of the racial ability score bonuses and things. And basically they're letting you get away with anything, you know, at this, they're separating everything. So,
okay. So
the latest Adventurers Guild guide contains new rules for customizing your PC, which are a preview of what's to come in a couple of months from the Tasha's Cauldron release. And so rules for altering your racial ability scores, modifiers, and racial traits, also weapon skills and tool proficiencies, are now all up for grabs. So instead of having, I have to play a dwarf because I want this, I have to play an elf because I want this, you're able to take those bonuses and apply them any way you want.
Hmm.
And I'm not sure, it doesn't say that there's like, you kind of need an in-game or narrative reason to be doing this. Like, why is your dwarf so super intelligent or, you know, whatever? Why is your orc so pretty?
Nobody saw my shrugs at both of those. Okay, yeah.
But I think this helps in a lot. And the interesting thing that Wizards of the Coast said, though, it doesn't seem like, at least in this edition, they're going to let go of the term race.
Okay.
But they're kind of explaining what they mean in their setting. According to Wizards of the Coast, race means fantasy species combined with certain cultural assumptions. And so they're trying to address the kind of real world weight of the word race, saying dwarves have a higher constitution because dwarf heroes or dwarf adventurers have that, not all dwarves. Like they're saying, you know, the character that you're creating is a hero or a adventurer. And so they're different
from,
you know, they're an outlier. So what do you think about that? You know, basically if you have a +2 and a +2, you can apply those to any abilities that you want. Or if you have a proficiency in hammers, you can make that a proficiency. In bows or whatever, you can kind of transfer things over. What do you think about?
Well, I think it's going to get a lot of complaints.
Right.
That's right off the bat. I wonder if there's some kind of, and I hate to use this word, I wonder if there's some kind of balancing factor where if they kind of like broke out everything or broke it all apart, they might say like, I don't think every piece that got broken out has equal weight.
Right, right.
I guess that's mechanically speaking, if you know what I mean. So I wonder if they did some kind of different charts where, okay, like you can pick a couple, like five from these or three from these or, you know, any combination thereof to balance it mechanically speaking, because that is kind of a concern in D&D. I think it's kind of a cop-out to do that fantasy race is both species and certain cultural aspects.
Mm-hmm.
D&D, in my opinion, kind of does the cultural thing as race anyway, which is why you have like moon elves, dark elves, all these different things, and I guess also from the way you kind of have to constantly make content for D&D, that's the way to make new species, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's an elf, and but it's going to be a dark elf, or a moon elf, or a silver elf, or a gold elf, or however many elves there were from all the different editions across time. Yeah. And, okay, I guess they're kind of saying it's both species and culture, and this elf culture is different from that elf culture, which is why we classify them as different races, mm-hmm. which, okay, I'm not thrilled about it, but I guess at least they seem to be recognizing it.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if it takes away, because we had a, I'll put a link to the discussion we had about kind of racial bonuses and things and what that does and how, like, and also having like half elves and half orcs.
You know, what kind of really puts a spanner in the works for me, because if you're doing everybody is pretty sexually compatible with everybody else to the point where you're making, for lack of a better term, like hybrids, mm-hmm. everybody is the same race, technically.
Right, right.
From a scientific standpoint. And then, so just make everybody the same race, right?
Right, right. I think it takes away, you know, the flavor, like what is a dwarf, what is an elf, if they can be anything, and if you can apply those bonuses anywhere. So it takes away some of that original flavor. And I think some people want that, but at the same time, it's also going to take away the narrative flavor, the narrative interest of why characters are the way they are. I mean, I guess you can come up with a reason for it, but it's now very nebulous. It's now I have aquatic dwarves that are, you know, super dexterous, and it's like
it's not like people weren't trying to do that already.
But I want to play John Wick. Yeah, that's true. The thing I do like about it, though, is it breaks away, because I really hate that, and I noticed that maybe more in Pathfinder, so that might be more of a 3.5 problem. Although I guess 5e has the same sort of thing where you're kind of railroaded into choosing a specific race if you want to play a certain character class.
Right. Yeah. This race, this class. Right. And these ability scores, otherwise you're not going to be effective at what you do.
Right.
And then people say, but we don't play to be effective. And then I'm like, well, okay, well, then play a different system where a miss doesn't mean nothing happens.
Right, yeah. Right.
If you're going to lean into those weird characters, for God's sake, play something other than D&D.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a good point. We'll see the full, in a couple of months, we'll see the kind of the full version of this. But you do have a preview, and I think you can download it for free to see what they're doing. But it seems like it just kind of throws everything up in the air. And I don't know. I don't know if that, what they're going to do with that. I mean, narratively, you can, you know, then create some very original, very exactly what you want to play kind of characters. But I think that should be a conversation that happens in kind of world building. So, you know, putting these characters into a pre-written module, a pre-written adventure is like, you could kind of be breaking certain things.
But is I understand that, but, and I wonder, not whose responsibility that is. I think that's one of those, like, even if you're running a pre-published module, I think that's one of the discussions you have before the game, saying, hey, we're running this module. Make characters who, A, B, C, D, or who would do thing main quest is about. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of on the group to have that discussion. And it's the GM's fault if they don't say, kind of, this is the main hook. Yeah. Make someone who wants to participate. And it's the player's responsibility to then make someone who wants to participate. As a player who, in the past, did not, it does not work out well. And then you're like, okay, let's rewrite this character so they actually do care about what's going on.
Right.
Otherwise, why are we playing?
I think that's important. And hopefully they're going to say something about that when they're talking about blowing up
D&D. Blowing up, yeah.
How you're making characters. Yeah, we'll see. We talked at the beginning of this year about this being the year of Dune.
Oh, yeah.
Because the re-release of the board game, there's a RPG coming, there's a film coming, and
there's not a book coming, it's already out.
Yeah, oh, that's right. There's probably more books coming, though. I'm sure you can't hold his son down when it comes to making money off of Dune. Yeah, so we've seen a trailer now for this film. But this film, the release date is now just hanging at the very end. I think it's December 18th
or
something.
Okay.
Yeah, so
I didn't know the release date.
It may still happen this year. Probably not, though.
Okay, you think it's going to get bumped?
Yeah, because if theaters are still under heavy restrictions, they're not going to waste the time.
Well, it's not like that 1984 version did gangbusters at the theater.
That's right. So what did you think of the trailer?
I thought it was boring. And I should preface this. I like the David Lynch 1984 version. Mm-hmm. I like how weird it is, and I like the voiceovers, and I like how it took this massive brick of a book and condensed it into a two-hour movie. Mm. I think it did an admirable job of doing that. It does have flaws. You needed those voiceovers to convey to the audience what the fuck is going on, and I actually kind of like them. But I also like all the weird colors and exotic costumes and kind of the bright graininess of that old footage. So the new one, I just went, wow, this is dark and gray and kind of boring. And I'm not that excited for it.
Yeah, it was interesting. I kind of recognized, you know, the look. I was really expecting from the Blade Runner 2049 that
horrible movie. Sorry,
but that orangeness of the wastelands, right. That really like warm, dead look that they got for not only like that casino.
Oh yeah, the Las Vegas.
Yeah, that kind of Las Vegas thing. I was really expecting that, and to see like a because that's the thing that I like that you can do visually is Caladan versus Arrakis having this like really stark contrast. And I didn't see that so much in the trailer. Yeah, but I did like the kind of really weird clean design, like the shots of like the ships landing and the troops lined up. It was like a 60s sci-fi novel cover, you know. There's something about that that made sense for me, and I like the casting a lot in this new film, so we'll see how the performances are. But as far as how everybody looks,
I don't really just have any problems with how people look in terms of like casting. Mm-hmm. Like I remember there was one shot of it's all those like Harkonnen troops lining up and people are like, oh, this is so big and epic, and I'm like, it looks boring. Like it's a big old ship with maybe part of why I think it's boring is knowing it's CG. And I'm not saying that CG is a cop out or isn't difficult to do, because you can do amazing stuff with CG and CG artists do a lot of work. Mm-hmm. But there's just for me something a bit less epic. Mm-hmm. In the knowing that it was all done in a computer as opposed to like map paintings or rotoscoping or kind of like models, which the original Dune movie had. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's also people getting like hyped up for it and me kind of going, all right, kind of that like,
You're still waiting for the Jodorowsky version, right? The psychedelic, insane Spanish director's release.
Yeah, I'm waiting for that. Also, people are like, wow, look at the worms. I'm like, nope, not really all that interested, but what I want to see, and I said this on Twitter, is a stage 4 Guild Navigator.
Oh, yeah.
Because unless it looks like that parrot thing from the David Lynch movie, I don't care. No.
So if it just bounces off the culture just like everything else. But there is, so Modiphius is developing a 2D20 version of Dune. And so we were part of the playtest for it. Yeah, we can't talk about it, but I thought it was, it's a 2D20 system and it kind of fits. But we've also, like, already discussed like throughout this year a few other systems that have good intrigue mechanics and things that may also work for the world of Dune. So I think there's it's really unfortunate that all this timing is getting knocked. Because they did a remake of the board game. You know, there was an RPG coming out, then the film, and just none of that is happening. There's zero synergy between the different products.
I've started reading the book again because last time I read it and the first time I read it, I think I was 14 because I remember freshman orientation is kind of high school, just reading that book, and I'm sure a lot went over my head. Reading it again, wow, the Bene Gesserit are terrible. Everybody in that movie, is terrible. I was like, wow, eugenics are not okay and all this stuff. Right. And a couple things that struck me is if you're going to do a role-playing game of Dune, the big one for me is, and I think I said this before, generations. I mean, you have factions in that book that are putting plans into motion that will not come to fruition until like millennia later.
Right, right.
And kind of sticking to that plan and not really knowing what it, or the other people not really knowing what it is. Mm-hmm. The other one that you mentioned is intrigue. Yes. Like, I forget what chapter it was, but it's the conversation at the beginning between like Dr. Yu and the Lady Jessica, where Dr. Yu is the traitor. We know he is. He knows that Jessica can detect truth and all the little kind of like tricks he does to try and throw her off the scent and mask stuff and her trying to figure out what's going on and the Harkonnens making that room for Paul, knowing he would be attracted to it and putting a hunter seeker in there. Mm-hmm. And hey, Dune spoilers. But it's that kind of stuff. It's not combat. Mm-hmm. It's trying to be three steps ahead of your opponent and putting things in place that they're not going to know about. And could an RPG do that? Because I think you would have to.
Yes.
If you're going to play a Dune-esque game.
It definitely has to have different scales. You can't just be playing kind of only boots on the ground characters. Mm-hmm. You're going to have like larger strategic things in play. But I really like your idea of multi-generational. And if that isn't included in the Modiphius system, that may be something worth, as part of world building, is like discussing with the game master, this is my plan. This is my motivation for my house. This is what we're going to do. And can you kind of fit that into your campaign?
I was wondering if you could play a role-playing game or a tabletop role-playing game like this, where you're not one character, where you're just playing the faction.
Right, right.
And would that be interesting? Mm-hmm. because, I mean, it almost kind of sounds a bit like a game of diplomacy, right, where you would probably be like passing the GM notes about what your faction, the things your faction is kind of like putting into place and trying to get over on the other ones. And but then there wouldn't be any interaction between the players, really.
Right.
Like you would have to then switch to kind of like, as you said, boots on the ground scene, mm-hmm, to do that. And maybe you could alternate between those two. Like, okay, right, we've made our plans. Now let's play out a scene from that where everyone's kind of interacting as boots on the ground characters, mm-hmm, and make sure you don't give your thing away. And then kind of the next round is, okay, now based on that personal scene, mm-hmm, trying to figure out what people are doing and are you going to change your plans and stuff like that. But right, I don't know if that's a role-playing game or more like a board game.
Yeah, no, that's true. That kind of strategy. So they did make reference in the playtest to different levels of play. And I don't know if that's going to mean what they did with Alien, where there's like a cinematic version campaign version. So there may be, yeah, so, you know, like you're saying, that there may just be you're playing your house, you know, that's your character in a campaign. You'd seem like you'd want to move between those and not have like only a campaign like, yeah, and I send my soldiers here and you steal my spice
here. That's a war game. That's pretty boring. Right. Well, that's the other thing I was thinking about, like the difficulty with any IP property. Because to me, the Dune story is that story of Paul becoming... Mm.
Right.
The Kwisatz Haderach. Who wants to play that again?
Right.
Right?
You're
either going to be the major players in the story and therefore know what happens, mm-hmm, or the nobodies.
Right.
Right? Like you're the little spice harvester guys who Duke Leto picks up in the Ornithopter. Like, who wants to play that game? Right,
right.
But if you don't interact with kind of the big noticeable chunks of an IP, are you playing that IP game?
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
It's the same problem you run into with Star Wars and Alien.
Yeah.
And basically anything with that noticeable IP, why not play another game if you don't have those noticeable elements in it? Too much of those big elements, why not just read the book or watch the movie?
Right. Yeah, no, I think it's a delicate balance, and to make something feel like Dune, but give you a reason to, why am I playing this system, this specific game? Yeah, that's a good point.
So we're playing Dune, but we're not on Arrakis or Gedi Prime or Caladan. Great, so are we playing? Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's very true. It has to give you a connection to that. Yeah, and so I think the theme and maybe that's also what we're talking about with the movie, though. Does this feel like the picture from the novel or your image from the 80s film? Does this look and feel like Dune? And yeah, maybe some people are feeling that's not quite it. Yeah, but yeah, I'm excited about the movie. Visually, I love what that director does. So we'll see how that goes. And this is also only the first half of the book, or a part of the book.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. So they're not going to try to get the whole book in. So yeah, it might be a little disappointing. I mean, and hopefully they do it, you know, immediately, like, to be continued next year.
I'm calling it now. I'm expecting there will be no part two.
Oh, yeah. Ouch. Yeah. Because they're not filming it at the same time. So it's all COVID dependent, profits.
I think it's going to be an unfortunate box office flop.
But Netflix will pick it up and make it a drama.
Hey, you know what? That would actually be better, a TV series.
That would be weird, yeah. That's going to happen eventually, but that would be very strange.
I think they already called one. There's like the Bene Gesserit Sisterhood or something that is a series in development.
Right.
And who wants to watch a bunch of eugenicists try and create the super being? I don't know.
I was hoping for CSI Caladan. That would be... So where can people find you?
On Twitter, as always. Tyvemynd, HYVEMYND.
If you'd like to get in touch with Idle Red Hands, idleredhands.com is the website. Follow us on Twitter at Idle Red Hands. We have both a Twitch and a YouTube channel. And if you'd like to get involved and support the podcast, please visit patreon.com/idleredhands. Because our hopes for Dune this year have been dashed, and we may barely get some of the things that were going to be released by the end of 2020, I thought I would read a couple of quotes from Frank Herbert, things that definitely apply to things we should be thinking about today. When religion and politics travel in the same cart, the riders believe nothing can stand in their way. Their movements become headlong, faster and faster and faster. They put aside all thoughts of obstacles and forget the precipice does not show itself to the man in a blind rush until it is too late. And also, governments, if they endure, always tend increasingly toward aristocratic forms. No government in history has been able to evade this pattern. And as the aristocracy develops, government tends more and more to act exclusively in the interest of the ruling class, whether that class be hereditary royalty, oligarchs of financial empires, or entrenched bureaucracy. And one more. Greatness is a transitory experience. It is never consistent. It depends in part upon the myth-making imagination of humankind. The person who experiences greatness must have a feeling for the myth he is in. He must reflect what is projected upon him, and he must have a strong sense of the sardonic. This is what uncouples him from belief in his own pretensions. The sardonic is all that permits him to move within himself. Without this quality, even occasional greatness will destroy a man. So that's it for this week. We'll see you next week.
Later, mortals.
Bye.
Smiles on a crucible glass. A step.